We're covering the news from Veeam's VeeamON event. We've got some discussion about Microsoft's Build Conference, the 2017 Channel 4 Visionaries, self-serve help desks, and a whole lot more. It's Channel 4 Weekly, episode 45, Rich Marked Man. Hello and welcome to Channel 4 Weekly, episode 45. My name is Matt Whitlock, your host and online technology guy here at Channel Pro. Joining me this and every week is our star-studded panel of super channel experts, senior news editor Rich Freeman.
Greetings.
As well as the lovely and talented executive editor Cecilia Galvin.
Why, thank you, Matt.
I was going to call you editor-in-chief again. I'm like, but I know that's not your title. That's why I keep getting confused about that. Even though that should be your title.
You could have
why
both.
Why not both? That would be good. Editor and executive chief.
Everybody else gets to be, you know, CEO and president. So,
right.
You know. Or CEO and CTO. So,
perhaps we could do like a mishmash of those things and do something like executive in chief.
There was a column that Mike Schmidtman wrote, oh my gosh, years ago. And in his column, which is usually about sales, he said you should be very worried if you have titles that no one else can really understand. Like they aren't real. Like when companies say that you're X and Y and people look at those and go, how is that related? He said, sure enough, you'll be the next one fired. Because they don't really know what to do with you. So I think I'll just keep the single title.
Well, that means that I would be up next on the chopping block because I have one of those weird and titles.
Yeah, but yours actually
makes sense.
Yeah, you just turn the Sherlock Holmes hat around, depending on
right,
which
so,
yeah,
so
job
for those
you're
who don't
doing.
Know, my official title is Online Director and Technology Editor. So, but the Online Director thing is kind of vague. So perhaps we should make that more specific, just so I got...
Yeah, you would think that you would have minions with that title. And Rich and I are
you're not even
minions.
Really minions. That's terrible. All right, minions. So, Rich, you are out on the road this week at Veeam. So why don't we go ahead and I know in our notes here we were going to talk about Build first. Well, let's go ahead and talk about Veeam since that's kind of where you're at and what you're doing.
Okay. Yes. So I am contributing my portion of this podcast from New Orleans, where I have spent the better part of the week attending the Veeam Partner and User Conference. In fact, that's still going on now. I kind of raced back here to the hotel to do the podcast. I've got two stories about this event up on our website already and two more coming later today. So these are off the top of my head kinds of thoughts about what's going on here. But Very interesting show and a very interesting company, Veeam. And so I'll just ask you two guys. I mean, we talk a ton at Channel Pro about BDR and backup and so on, and names like Datto and StorageCraft and Carbonite come up a bunch in that context. My impression, for better or worse, is that Veeam has not been one of those sort of tip of the tongue kind of names that that we go to immediately when we're talking about backup and business continuity. Would it be fair to say that's kind of your feeling too? That there are other names that come to mind sooner?
Yes, and there's good reason for that. A while back, I had been working with Veeam, and they had done a contributed piece for us at one point, and I just really loved it. It was done by their CEO, and it was just very insightful and very different from a lot of the kind of contributed pieces that I've seen. This one was not about anything that Veeam does or is involved in. It was really talking about Web 2.0 and the technologies that were coming out at the time that people should be able to take advantage of. So that was my first intro to Veeam. And where back then, the company was kind of SMB focused, they moved upstream a little bit and started really focusing more on mid-market and above. So that's kind of why there's not a ton of outreach to the SMB channel. They're, except
so
the,
interesting, interesting that you say. That's kind of an interesting part. Setup. Well, they never left. They never left. They are definitely in the midst
SMB,
of
right?
a push up
no.
market.
Okay.
I came back here to do this recording session, having just done two interviews with Veeam executives. One of those executives is a gentleman named Kevin Rooney, who is in charge of their channel in North America. And I was asking him questions along the lines of what you're just saying there, and you know how I hear a lot about the service provider channel, and I know you guys are pushing upstream. Should anyone in your SMB channel be thinking there's been a diminishment of commitment there? And he was really, really adamant, basically that they've never stepped away from SMB in any way. They've just been sort of augmenting resources, so they. They've hired 1,000 new people, mostly on the sales side, just in North America in the last year, and a lot of those people are going to be focused on, bigger businesses and so on. But it's not as if they've diverted resources away from their sort of SMB base. From their perspective, they're just kind of and one of the things that Kevin Rooney was saying is, if you're an SMB partner, this is all
okay.
just kind of good for you because you can go upstream with us if you choose to. This is just more opportunity for you to tap into if you want. So, the last time I wrote about them before this event was back around December last year, and at that point in time, 40% of their revenue was coming in from SMB business. And so one of the things I checked about today is, where does that number stand? And it's dropped a little bit, but it's still roughly around there. And the only reason that that percentage has dropped is because they're bringing in more enterprise business, and that obviously sort of tilts the scale a little bit, because those are bigger deals and so on. But they're still going like gangbusters in SMB. And to kind of circle back, part of the reason why I asked, is this a name that comes immediately to mind? It wasn't certainly for me. It will probably come to mind more quickly, having been here now, because these guys are just exploding, basically. The growth is, their latest quarterly financial statement came out just a few weeks ago. And it showed 33% year-over-year growth, just overall revenue. And the cloud portion of their business, which is really sort of the strategic thing that they're building on, was up, I want to say off the top of my head, something like 59% year-over-year. Some of the other statistics that they were kicking around here, they pulled in as much revenue in the first 2 months of 2017, wow, as they did in all of their fiscal 2013. They've been averaging 4,000 new customers a month for something like the last 6 or 7 quarters straight, and they're up to 245,000 customers worldwide right now. So, it's this not an enormous company, a big company, but not an enormous company. $800 million in revenue. They're expecting to push that to $1 billion by the end of this year. Part of what they're doing, so part of what's going to get them to that goal and beyond, basically, is they are building on their legacy. So Veeam, and I just learned this week, if you're wondering what the heck the name Veeam is about, that is sort Yeah, that is an allusion to VM, virtual machine, Veeam. They started out as a company that sold backup solutions specifically for virtual machines.
In
the early running, it was specifically for virtual machines on VMware. And then they added Hyper-V support at some point down the road. What they're doing now, their new vision, is to go beyond virtual machine backups. They want to be able to back up any workload, virtual, physical, cloud-based, on-site or off-site, basically. So you can, ultimately, you're going to be able to back up a workload in the cloud to your on-premises system or vice versa. You're going to be able to back up data that's sitting on a physical server, on a virtual server, on a server in Microsoft Azure, whatever. It's all going to flow anywhere you need it to. And their big news this week, so they made a ton of announcements here, a lot of product-related announcements, and basically it was just some steps, good solid steps in the direction of that vision, where they have added the ability to back up AWS workloads now. They announced, they shipped a new agent for Windows devices, so they now have the ability to back up physical Windows servers and endpoints. And they announced that by the end of the year, they're going to have some integrated management capabilities around that as well. They added, just today, in fact, so this isn't even up on our website yet, but it will be in a little while. Today, they announced that Microsoft Azure is now a recovery target for backup. So if you want to restore data that you need to take or to utilize during a service interruption of some kind, you can do that in Microsoft Azure beginning immediately. It's a company that's growing really, really fast. They have a very, very ambitious sort of vision that they're pursuing. And they're actually, making concrete progress towards it. It's not just something they've tossed up on the whiteboard. So for me, it was just a very interesting couple of days here, taking a sort of Veeam crash course.
Wow. Very different than what I had imagined. But I do know that a lot of our Channel Pro readers are interested in Veeam. And the name does come up at kind of odd moments and always in a very positive way. So I knew that.
Right.
Certainly from going to our events and everything.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Sometimes having conversations.
And actually, it would be interesting
just to
do a comparison.
The name Veeam has actually
come up over the course of the last few years.
And it does pretty well on our surveys,
the Reader's Choice survey.
Like when we're doing Reader's Choice Awards.
I spoke with a gentleman. The last interview I did here before coming over was with a gentleman named John Metzger, who is a very senior person on the product side of the house. And one of the questions I was asking him basically is, To what extent are you pursuing this vision and bringing your partners along with you? And to what extent are they sort of pushing you in that direction, in a sense? And he said it's a little bit of both. You know, that there are a lot of partners out there who came to the company via that virtual machine backup capability who have been lobbying them, essentially, to add physical server or physical device backup as well. It's like, I like this product. Boy, it would be great if I could do the physical machines along with the virtual ones. And then, obviously as cloud-based workloads become a bigger and bigger piece of the story, you've got to include that as well. So,
And I think that that's exactly what you just described is the way that a lot of vendors end up really pushing their solution offerings much further, perhaps, than they even thought about. It's the pressure from their partners. If they really, really like your products and they really like your service and everything about your company
and
they're loyal
to you, those partners
you're
describing
stick with what they have, but they have
or enjoy the same benefits,
sure,
basically,
the
from consolidation
that
an end user does.
Can
we talk sometimes
meet those
about
needs
the one throat to choke kind of thing from
so
an end user standpoint.
That's one of the really dynamic things that I like.
Fewer phone numbers to juggle and so on. But I mean, it obviously applies to a channel partner as well. And if you're doing business today with multiple BDR vendors because they each have, you know, slightly different capabilities, the idea that you might be able to consolidate that spend a little bit and have fewer people to interface
sure.
with and just kind of do it all through through one vendor is it's going to be an appealing one for those partners. And so that, you know, I guess the question, the longer-term question is just, you know, what does this strategy, this vision, and the growth and the progress that they're making, what does that wind up meaning for some of the companies that we were talking about right at the beginning of this segment, the Dattos and the Storage Crafts? And, you know, I mean, are those guys headed towards some sort of collision, you know? I mean, I don't know. It'll be an interesting thing to watch.
Very cool. Well, so the other big question about this Veeam event, Rich, is what else you're doing in New Orleans other than attending this event?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I've been remarkably well behaved. I mean,
it's not. I know it's not Mardi Gras time, so I don't know if he's going up to you and like putting beads around your neck, trying to get you to lift your top or anything. But what else have you gone to any good restaurants? Have you done anything else fun?
Yes, yes, yeah, absolutely. I was on my way over here,
I find that
a couple
so
days ago,
hard
I was
to believe.
Back and forth a little bit with our friend Joel Zade Spinner. Who was here as well, and he was kind of, I made some joke, because he got here hours before I did, and I made some joke about, go get yourself some beignets, and he said, no, that's not a fit with my diet, and I wrote back, New Orleans is a bad place to be on a diet, and yeah, to the extent that I have been a bad boy, that you know, you can't help but eat plenty and eat really well here, and so yeah, Joel and I went out to a restaurant that conference goers who have been to New Orleans will probably know, called Cochon, which is wonderful, and had a wonderful meal there. And last night I went to a place I like here in New Orleans called Sylvain, I may be reading too much into this, but it felt like a New Orleans experience because it was like a really long day yesterday and a very late dinner. And they weren't even really seating in the main part of the restaurant. I sat down at the bar, and the bartender came over, and I asked for a menu and an enormous gin and tonic. And she, this was meant, you know, in jest, basically, but she came back with a menu and an enormous gin and tonic. You ask for a large gin and tonic in New Orleans, and that's what you get. I don't know, it could be. Oh, no. So that place is literally right around the corner. So Kershan is sort of the first.
That's what you get.
Place
now,
by that,
is that
name.
The place that had the pig sign hanging outside?
I'm blanking on the name of the chef. He's got a ton of restaurants in New Orleans.
Is it?
There's Kershan, and then right around the corner is Kershan Butcher, which is
Butcher?
Like a sandwich beer, and also terrific, by the way, but definitely less fancy. Not that Kershan is terribly fancy, but it is more of a sit-down table service kind of deal.
I will personally give any listener who comes up to Joel, or not Joel, to Rich while in New Orleans or in a future event and puts a string of beads around him.
Got it.
If you can get a picture of that, we will put you up on the website and we will... we will find some kind of prize for you for that particular photograph. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. I'm going to have to sneak to the airport. And I'm a marked man now.
All right. So the Veeam event is what you're doing this week. But there was another big event that we did not get a chance to talk about last week. But I think it's worth going through a couple of the announcements that came out of that. So let's talk Build, Rich. So for our listeners, can you explain what Microsoft Build is?
Absolutely. And just quick, funny aside there, they hosted that. I was home in Seattle last week, and that's where they hosted Build, and yet I did not actually attend Build. I was just up the road a little ways. So Build is Microsoft's annual conference for developers. They've been going through this process in recent years of consolidating their events, and they've kind of got it down to a big four, an IT pro event, a partner event, a decision maker event, and Build, which is the one that they target at developers. And, you know, a company as big as Microsoft, you limit yourself to four events a year, you're going to have a lot of stuff to talk about at those events. And boy, oh boy, did they have a lot to talk about at Build last week.
Yes, they did.
Shall I dive into that?
Yeah. No, sorry. Yeah, sorry. I was starting to talk, but I forgot that I had to mute myself briefly. So it is important to point out that Build is first and foremost a developer event, not necessarily a channel event. So there's always going to be a lot of overlap, kind of as you are alluding to, because, you know, they're consolidating a lot of their events. And resellers are also touching a lot of the things.
Couple of highlights, please.
We're talking about Build, but this is not their partner show, which will be coming up later. That's coming up soon, isn't it? July. Okay, yeah. So that event will definitely have a lot of very relevant partner type of information. But Microsoft always has lots to talk about at Build, and it always is interesting. So, Rich, why don't we talk about a couple of the highlights, and then we'll see where that goes from there.
So there were basically two big waves of announcements at Build. And so in that first wave on the first day of the show during the big general session, they discussed a whole bunch of different things. And, you know, it's like from the standpoint of covering an event like that, part of the challenge is just figuring out how to bucket these things. But a bunch of them fell into what I would call an artificial intelligence bucket. And, you know, we've talked before about how enormous the artificial intelligence market is, and how intense the competition in that space is already, how big Microsoft's ambitions for artificial intelligence are. They are painfully conscious of the fact that they were late to mobility, and so late, in fact, that they really just kind of blew it in that area. They have no intention whatsoever in being late to or blowing it in artificial intelligence. And so pretty much any time they do a show these days, they're going to be talking about that. And some of what they talked about at Build last week has to do with some sort of specific artificial intelligence offerings that developers can take advantage of now. You know, a year ago at this time, there was a lot of vision, artificial intelligence vision stuff coming out of Microsoft. Last week, they rolled out 29 AI services that a developer can just sort of tap into via API and utilize in their solution. So if you you want to build speech translation capabilities into your system, there's you know, an AI-powered kind of service that you can do for that from Microsoft. If you want to take advantage of a service that can actually analyze images, can look at pictures and identify patterns and spot things for you, that there's a service for that. So 29 of those services that they rolled out last week. A bunch of new developer tools on that first day as well, including a version of Visual Studio for Mac that went into general availability. Azure-hosted implementations of the MySQL and PostgreSQL databases, a new API for Microsoft Graph that's going to allow developers to utilize data in Office 365 in their apps in interesting ways. That could lead to some interesting product extensions and integrations. And then there were some other sort of news around Office 365 that day in terms of, you know, developers can now create apps for Microsoft Teams if they want to extend the capabilities of that system.
Right.
All that's just day one, right? And I'm leaving out a whole bunch of stuff. So day two, and, you know, as an ex-Microsoft guy, it's hard for me to believe that, you know, this was almost like the also-ran news, the day two news. They sort of officially pulled the wraps off of the next big release of Windows, which had been codenamed Redstone 3. And they told us last week it will officially be known as Windows 10 Fall Creators Update. And we don't know exactly when that reaches market. I believe that they're still thinking towards the end of this year. But they gave everybody a sneak peek at that, and in particular a sneak peek at the new design language, the new UI that will debut with that OS. And I am guessing
A lot of what's in Redstone 3 is some of the stuff that got cut from Redstone 2. So it's not surprising they're continuing to call this the Creators Update, because this includes some of the things that were supposed to be in the Spring Creators Update, but kind of got pushed back. But there is a lot under the covers here that Microsoft has been building and working on that, if the schedule sticks true, will be debuting in Redstone 3. The new Fluent design language is interesting. I don't even know where to even begin talking about this. So, Rich, I would call it an evolution of Metro. Would you kind of go with that?
I mean, as opposed to a.
So
like
I'm going
to
say that I don't think this is a radical shift in the look and the style that Microsoft introduced with Metro, but I do believe what they're working on bringing back is a little bit more of the things that other people look at other types of UIs on competitive platforms, and I would say is eye candy, and they're bringing some of that into Windows, but hopefully in a way that extends the user interface to be to enhance the UI with some natural types of fluent interactions that aid in navigation rather than just provide motion and whiz-bangy eye candy stuff for the sake of having whiz-bangy eye candy stuff. But I think Microsoft played this one out a little early. I don't think that you're going to even see a lot of this new design language in Redstone 3. But really there was nothing to even say that Microsoft's own apps are going to be using this language anytime in the near future. But if they get behind it and they make it so that app creators and app builders can lock onto this language and use this in their own designs, and it makes sense and it's cohesive, they might hopefully someday be able to make one cohesive look for Windows. That, at least that was what I took out of it. Rich, what did you take out of it?
I'm not really the guy to ask about that kind of thing. It's like, for me, what I took out of it is, hey, transparency. They're building some transparency into the Windows. What that winds up meaning from a channel perspective or an end user perspective, I don't really know. And it's sort of interesting hearing you talk about it because without really thinking about it in a deep way, I sort of assumed there was some sort of functional benefit to this fluent design language that it's something more than eye candy, to use the term that you use there, but it sounds like that's maybe still TBD. It's a little hard to know whether it actually improves the user experience in any way or enables people to interact with the operating system more easily, or if it just kind of looks
from everything like I've read. I guess I'm a little jaded because like the reaction to this whole fluent design system that they're kind of talking about, which has everything to do with material design and UI design and all this stuff. Again, the reaction is so overblown that it seems to me like this, we're setting ourselves up for another Longhorn moment. Like, remember when Microsoft debuted this awesome demonstration of what Longhorn, the fabled Windows version after XP, that was supposed to be object oriented and do all this amazing things, and it completely just never happened. I fear a little bit of this might never really come to fruition, but we'll just have to wait and see it out. But I'm not even sure this was even the most exciting thing. I think the most exciting thing coming in Redstone 3 that I think is going to be absolutely game-changing is all of this underpinning code that's going to allow Windows, this x86 software emulation layer, it's going to allow Windows to run on ARM devices, starting with the Snapdragon 835, which they showed a video demo of at Build, that will this emulation layer is regular Windows, all of the x86 applications that you know and use for the last 15 years will be instantly be able to run on this new type of mobile centric hardware with deep cellular and connectivity features that's inherent to ARM designs, and I think that's going to be a game changer in hardware and some of the things that we expect to see the PC evolve into.
You know, what's potentially an interesting tie-on to that is another aspect of this OS we haven't kind of talked about, but it is something that they emphasized from the main stage last week, is that they're building all sorts of functionality into Redstone 3 that will allow you to sort of merge experiences across Windows devices, Android devices, and iOS devices. So, there's functionality now basically that kind of allows you to pick up on a tablet where you left off on a PC if they're both running Windows and so on, and they're kind of extending that out to Android and iOS as well. I don't know if that sort of dovetails with this whole idea that the ARM platform becomes part of the Windows world as well, but it's certainly a connection point between Windows and
well,
mobile
yeah,
market,
this is going to affect a lot today. at the types of devices we see running Windows, and one of the areas where Windows has traditionally or Microsoft has had a, kind of a lock is that they've been very reliant on Intel and AMD x86 because the vast majority of line of business apps and popular applications that people know and use and love run, have required that process, those kinds of processors. But the mobile portfolio for both Intel and AMD is just not as strong as ARM. So Chromebooks and Android devices all have these inherent advantages when you start looking at like ultra mobile PCs and tablets, because ARM has gotten significantly more performance driven, but it's still very good with battery life. It has in the Qualcomm case, it's deep ties to cellular connectivity that's at the core of that SoC. So Microsoft is bringing a lot of those things that you would expect mobile devices to have into the Windows Fold. And I could even expect to say that even though they didn't talk about Windows 10 mobile a lot, I think it's going to be pretty clear that if Windows 10 continues to go this route, it will be one Windows that runs on, phones. Like this, we're kind of seeing the beginning of the next version of Windows Phone, if you will. But I don't think they're going to push it as a phone. It's going to be an all-in-one productivity device, and you're going to see Continuum kind of continue to evolve to do this transformational nature. Again, whether or not people want that, I don't know. But that's what we're gonna start seeing.
As you were talking about that, one of these great white whales in the tech industry for the past few years has been the Surface Phone. Almost any time Microsoft hosts a major conference, you can go online and Google this, folks. You will find a bunch of articles in the days leading up to the event where people ask, is this where we see the Surface Phone? And I mean, sure enough, there were stories like that. Actually, in this case with Build, the stories that I saw were mostly along the lines of, we probably won't see the Surface Phone. But it was like, they still anticipated the question. you know, as you're kind of talking about this, in a way, there was really never any chance we were going to see a Surface phone until they got this ARM thing straightened out, right? I mean, they weren't really likely to launch a Surface phone, if they even intend to do that, on some, let's just call it, inferior processor platform. So, I mean, there could very well be a Surface phone coming down the road, but that probably is something that happens after.
Yeah, there's a lot in Redstone 3 that has to get before anything like that is really possible. But there's a whole bunch of other, you know, underlying technologies that are bubbling in development right now as it relates to, you know, to more about VR and more about continuum experiences and all this kind of stuff. So for those interested, check out the website. We've got some links out to some stories, and hopefully we'll maybe get a chance to talk a little bit more about this stuff as we learn more about Redstone 3. But I think we're gonna move on here, because we got a lot to cover and not a lot of time to cover it in. So stick around. We're gonna take a break, and when we come back, we've got a couple features and an interview and some more. So stick around. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to part two of Channel Pro Weekly. So we were talking build and Veeam in part one, but we've got some interesting stories and features that we want to talk about here. One of them is the Channel Pro Visionaries. Cecilia, do you want to take this one, or Richard, is this one you?
It's everyone.
It's everyone.
I was going to defer to you, Celia. This is the cover story of our May issue, and so, yeah, why don't you set it up?
Okay, so we started doing the Visionaries a couple of years ago. This is our third annual. I think so. And
yeah, I think that's right.
This has no... All right, do me a favor, Rich, and talk just a little bit about... what makes a visionary for Channel Pro? Like, what did we look at as a group? Because everybody at Channel Pro has a part in this. What did we look at, and how did we ultimately decide? That's the easiest thing to start.
And I'll add just a little bit more setup. So this is, I'm nearly positive you're right, this is our third visionaries piece. Concept started out basically that we were going to have this list, and in fact, in the first 2 years, we called it our 2020 Visionaries list, because we had 20 channel pros and 20 sort of channel players, people from the vendor community, analysts, and so on. And we were looking for people who are clearly recognized thought leaders in the SMB channel, and you know, we would kind of come up with the top 20 every year and put them on the list. And for various reasons, we decided, you know, the list winds up looking very similar year to year if you construct it that way. So we did things a little bit different this year. We dropped that whole 2020 concept, and we're just calling it the Channel Pro Visionaries. And we're kind of... tying your qualification for the list to something that you did in the last 12 months. So as opposed to merely being a recognized thought leader in the channel and somebody, you know, we at Channel Pro go to for smart takes on where things are headed and so on, we said, let's look for people who have done something concrete in the last 12 months that strikes us as visionary, that strikes us as forward-thinking, you know, especially
and really thought leadership,
constructive and actionable,
and things
and,
that
you know,
the
moves the puck ahead. Choose your
yeah,
or just anybody who came along and struck Rich with a big stick.
So yeah, this is now the second thing. So yeah, you know, you've got people trying to put Mardi Gras beads on me, and other people trying to hit me over the head with a stick so they can make our list.
I see a
I'm
show
in
title
grave
like
danger
this is
on the road.
This is like the Rich the Marked Man edition or something like that. Anyway, so yeah, so it's a good list of guys and lasses on here. Some really
right.
I like this approach a lot better right. Because I do like being able to look at something that somebody's done and say, this was a visionary thing, you know, recently. Otherwise, there's so many people, you're right, that are that have been visionary or thought leaders in the channel. But we want to recognize the ones that, you know, maybe have been visionary recently as opposed to 10 years ago, you know.
And the thing is that tying it to something that happened within the past year gives us an opportunity to introduce new people to our readers who they may not know about because they may not have, you know, they may not be as visible in the channel, or it may give them an interesting idea about something that they'd like to do within their own company that maybe they had been toying around with the idea and now they see someone who's actually doing it. And it's, you know, it helps to have peers like yourself who are doing things that you have an interest in and you might want to take that as your own for your own company. And it, you know, unfortunately, the downside of doing it this way is that it limits the list a little bit. And, you know, I think from what we learned doing it this year, that as we move on and really kind of refine the way we kind of debate these things, we should be able to broaden the list a little bit and bring you more interesting people, because the channel is all about people. So we're looking for them.
Sure is. And let's talk about a few of those people. Maybe we can all pick one person on the list to briefly talk about. So, Rich, your choice.
Well, I will talk then, if I only get one, I will talk about the last person on the list, actually, Luke Walling. And that's a name that will be familiar to some folks listening to the podcast now. He's been in the channel a long time. Most recently, he worked at AVG, and he was at Avast for a while after Avast bought AVG. And Avast, of course, is headquartered in Prague, and so Luke was spending some time in Eastern Europe and discovered as he was there that there are all sorts of great smaller ISV software vendors in Eastern Europe with products that channel pros in North America would probably get a lot of use out of you know, be able to sell to their customers and so on, but nobody here in North America knows about these products, and these companies in Eastern Europe don't even really know how to bring their product to market in North America. And so this was an opportunity, basically, he realized. And he left AVG, and created a business called Temprano Techvestors. And basically what he does, he sort of serves as the North American sales and marketing arm for all of these Eastern European software makers. And so, you know, it's a wonderful thing for those companies. They get to bring their products to the North American market. It's a great thing for channel pros in North America because all of a sudden there are these really kind of interesting security, for example, solutions that you just never would have known about otherwise that you can evaluate along with all the other more familiar products out there. So just a really smart kind of vision, shall we say, on his part, spotting that opportunity and stepping in to do something about it.
And Ms. Cecilia, who would you like to talk about?
Well, I do have my favorite, and that's Libis Bueno, who we've spoken about on the podcast before. But instead of talking about Libis, you'll have to go read about him if you didn't hear us talking on the podcast about him. I'd like to introduce everyone to Jim Kennedy, who's the CEO of a managed services company called the Network Support Company. And Jim Kennedy is really, really big on corporate culture and really moving the needle forward, even from a productivity and process point of view, by really engaging his employees. And he follows he talks about his company as a just culture. So what they do is they really work with employees who have done something incorrectly, inadvertently, made a mistake, and they kind of support one another. Like if one of the technicians loses a client's data, you know, they console the person because, of course, the person feels horrible about it because they're very invested in their clients and that sort of thing. So Kennedy has been really working with his team throughout the years. And this past year, he got another idea, and he puts his technicians in charge of meeting key objectives. And the really interesting thing about that is that there are no managers involved in that. It's, you know, rather than just try to, you know, micromanage the engineers about, you know, documenting all the work that they're doing, he wanted them to manage themselves and set up a dashboard so they could check their timeliness, and they get small monetary rewards for meeting certain targets. So he then like went even further, and he divided them into teams and did some other incentives so that the technicians kind of work with one another as a team and bring one another along to get their teams to be working at peak efficiency. And I thought that that was like really incredible, like no interference from any of the management, and just a great way to, you know, support other people in the workforce and make money doing it.
Well, you know what I like about his story is it's not like he he's very right. serious about corporate culture. There are probably a lot of channel pros who are very serious about corporate culture, but I mean, it's not as if Jim Kennedy is applying a system, right? You know, it's not like he read a book somewhere and okay, here's how I'm going to do it. He's really kind of going his own way and applying his own ideas and experimenting, basically. He has an open-mindedness yep. and a willingness to try all sorts of different things and kind of see what works. And so he winds up doing a lot of things that other people aren't doing, basically.
Very cool. And speaking of somebody
Matt,
who...
That leaves you. Who,
I was going to say, speaking of somebody who did... write a book or read a book. The one I'm going to talk about real quick is our good friend Manuel Palachuk. So if anybody who's been at one of our live events or has been following Channel Pro for a while would knows that we are quite close to the brothers Palachai, Carl and his brother Manuel, and Manny is a fascinating character. He's a very interesting guy. He's very personable. He's very kind. He's very nice. He's absolutely hilarious. But he's smart as a whip, and he's got a lot of experience in IT that he's learned as he worked in the IT industry and did businesses and all of these things, and 30 years ish of his experience in IT has finally come together into a book that came out in January called Getting to the Next Level, a blueprint for taking your business to the top. It's an excellent book. I'm about halfway through it personally. And if you guys know Manny, it's almost like when I'm reading this, I'm hearing him like tell it to me. And it's a great read, and he's just very insightful, very smart guy, and this would be a good read for just about anybody who is running an IT business. I would even go a little bit beyond IT, because there's a lot in here just about building culture and measuring success and establishing a good vision and clear roadmap and strategy kind of stuff. So great book so far, and a great guy. So if you're interested
great
in this
guy.
Book, we're going to put a link
really?
to this book
very
on Amazon
funny.
in the show notes page, or you can just go to Amazon, just type in Getting to the Next Level, and you should be able to find it there. Well worth it. So that is who I'm going to talk about is Mr. Manuel Palachuk. Anything you guys want to say about Manny before we move on?
Engineering,
there are so many
right?
things I could say. Yeah. he really... One of the things that's really interesting about him is he did not he spent a bunch of years working outside the IT or at least IT services world. I think he had some jobs in the aerospace sector. I know he was working for big time electronics companies. And yeah, exactly. And so it was like he spent years and years basically cultivating expertise in systems and process and organization, and then he decided he was ready to kind of make a change in his life, and his brother Carl said, hey, why don't you come work with me in this managed services business I'm building? And Manny brought all of that sort of systems expertise to running a managed services practice, and that's how, you know, really both Palachek's came to be such believers
in being
rigorous about how you do things. And there's a lot of that in the book, basically. So he has a really different kind of background and training that he brings to the kind of work our readers do. And it's I just think it lends a useful perspective to a lot of the advice he offers.
Well said. All right. Good. Great. So there's a whole bunch more on that list. If you want to go and read about some of them, and you know, if you have questions about them, or maybe we'll talk about a few of these other visionaries on the show here as we go forward. So, Cecilia, if there's anything that's coming to a fast food restaurant near you, it's self-serve kiosks. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about self-serve help desks.
I was wondering where you were going with that.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about this feature?
Okay. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one, but we did a short story about self-serve help desks. And, you know, if you talk to technicians, they will say that sometimes they wish that their customers could help themselves. And it turns out that there is this sort of like groundswell of interest on the part of end users to be able to help themselves when they have some kind of a problem for which they'd normally call the help desk. So it's, you know, all about, I guess, empowering the user. And we talked to a really smart VP and principal analyst at Forrester Research who actually wrote a report called Your Customers Don't Want to Call You. And I found that, like, really fascinating. And she said it's totally true because what's happening now is they'll often go to, like, self-serve kind of places to figure out what they need to do. If they can't find the answer quickly, then they escalate it like to the help desk. But they really don't want to call you for a lot of this basic stuff. So a lot of things that you can do in your managed service business or your reseller business is, you know, give your clients some tools that they can use, whether it's, you know, frequently asked questions that they have at their fingertips for doing, you know, some basic stuff, any kind of tips, lists kind of thing. That would be, you know, really helpful. But the thing that you need to keep in mind is you have to be able to kind of walk that line between letting customers do things themselves and you know, empowering them to resolve some issues faster than maybe your technicians can get back to them on it. But you have to be clear about what is something that is easy for an end user to do that will not further frustrate them. And then what is something that could actually, you know, end up being a truck roll. I mean, you need to be very clear about the line you're going to walk on that. Anybody want to add to that?
I mean, you know, I guess just to point out, it's sort of an interesting phenomenon.
Sure.
Because, like you said, I mean, it both potentially lowers,
yep,
overhead for a managed service provider, you know, to the extent that your customers can take care of something. But it also responds to a demand from the end users, right? I mean, you just think about the extent to which people are doing self-serve everything, basically, these days. And, you know, the younger people in particular really prefer that model. That's sort of the default,
yeah,
model. And you don't even have to be that young. You could be my age. And, I mean, when's the last time I actually phoned up a human being when I needed to plan travel, right? Like, I want to sit down in front of some system and do that on my own. And so it's the same thing with help desk stuff. Yeah, potentially it's an everybody wins kind of scenario where the end user gets to resolve some issues the way they prefer doing anyway, and there's a little less help desk work for the managed service provider to worry about. And the trick is just like you said, making sure that you're not creating barriers, basically. You're empowering people to resolve some help desk issues on their own, but also still allowing them to get through to a human being easily.
Right. And the whole idea is that you need, in a self-serve kind of a way, you need to provide things that have very specific answers to specific questions. It can't be vague. You know, 1, 2, 3, this is what you do.
Right. Well, I'll, the only thing I'll have to add to this, and I totally agree, you took my point right from me about younger people in the workforce now. This, and as they grow and become business owners and they become, a lot of these people, this is the model that they prefer and that they expect. They they do not like to talk to people.
Ask a young person to make a telephone call. It won't happen.
It's very difficult. They prefer self-service types of things. They prefer the self-serve line in the grocery store. They're going to prefer a kiosk at the fast food place that I was kind of talking about, where they go and they punch in their order and they get to pick exactly what goes on there, and they like texting. They like anything that has to do with not talking to a human being. So I think you hit that right on the nose. What I'll also say is this self-serve help model can also be very helpful for your help desk process, right? Especially if you can start to give these people some of the basic troubleshooting things that you or your technicians might be doing when they open up this ticket or take this call. You might be able to get them to do a little bit of that for you in advance. So that way, when they come to you, if they need to file a ticket, some of these things will already be done, and then you can hit the ground running with more information and spend less time on any particular service ticket. Depending on the problem, of course, but I think if you play it right, you can have the customer do a little bit of your help. Tech help or service work for you before they come to you to actually solve the problem.
And actually have them thanking you for that, because that's kind of how they want to do things.
They're a glutton for self-punishment, I guess, these people. this conversation and this feature, we'll put a link to it in the show notes, of course, self-serve help desks. Go and read that. But this dovetails right in to our interview that we're going to do this week in a very interesting way. So, Rich, tell us about Larry Meador. Or Meador, if you're going to pronounce it that way.
I think he pronounces it the way you did first.
Okay.
But
I think the second way sounded much fancier. But
it does. Yeah, undeniably. Once a week on our website, we post something called the Channel Pro 2-Minute Drill. It's a video, usually about 2 minutes long, features somebody from the vendor community sharing mostly thought leadership information on some topic or another. And last week, our 2-Minute Drill piece featured Larry Meador from a company called Channel Online, which makes an online procurement solution for purchasing hardware and software, basically. And so sort of as a follow-up to that, I figured this week we could listen to a portion of an interview I recorded with him, actually the same day that I recorded that video. And so he will basically take us, introduce us to Channel Online, and you will here very quickly, I think, how it does indeed dovetail to the conversation that we were just having there. The other thing you will hear, I'll say quickly, as Larry and I were talking during this interview, he was demoing the system for me, and so you're going to hear various little chimes and dings and bells. That was the system talking to us.
So as a starting point, Larry, for the benefit of people listening right now who are maybe not familiar with Channel Online, give us an overview of what the solution is, what it does.
Absolutely. So Channel Online, number one, we've been around for about 16, 17 years now. It is an online tool designed to give the reseller, the MSP, tremendous efficiency in their transactional model. Because we have the reseller has their own online account, so they can access it from anywhere. But they can manage all of their customers, all of their distribution partners, and from there they can do product research, side-by-side product comparisons, they can put products into quotes, they can build complex proposals or statements of work. They can send those quotes out to their customer. We also have an e-commerce store portal available to them that they brand as their own so that the customers, their customers, can shop with them 24/7. And then to complete the transaction, we have procurement hooks back into many of our different distribution partners, which we do have 25 distributors that support Channel Online. Many of them support the capability to electronically transmit purchase orders straight into the distributor system, which eliminates a lot of time. Number one, it's efficient, but it eliminates the chance of error happening because we're transmitting it straight into the distributor system, at which point they transmit back a confirmation number, shipping and tracking information, even serial number information, so that the reseller, the MSP, has everything contained in one place right in their Channel Online account. So it's really just designed to give the reseller and the MSP tremendous efficiency in their transactional model.
So 25 distributors. So, I mean, you can kind of shop those distributors against one another a little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of the tool here. That's where the efficiency comes in, because when you drill down to a specific product, whether it's a rack server, whether it's a notebook computer, it comes up on your screen and it shows you which of your distribution partners have it skewed up, number one, who has it in stock and what their inventory levels are, and who's got the best cost, all on one screen. So you don't have to go to multiple websites. You don't have to make multiple phone calls. You got it all on one screen right in front of you. And then we can even do real-time availability. We go out and grab a catalog from all of the distributors once every 24 hours. So your information is fresh, but to get real-time availability, you're down at the individual product level. You click on a link. We go out and bring back the inventory as it exists right at that moment, any cost changes that might have happened, and we expand the reseller's view and show them exactly what warehouse locations by distributor have the product in stock.
So you mentioned, you know, one of the system's capabilities is the storefront capability, the ability basically to allow for an MSP or a VAR to allow their customers to place orders, research and place orders through the MSP or VAR's website. Seems like younger end users in particular are into self-serve everything these days. Are you seeing a trend towards self-serve provisioning out there?
We absolutely are. And we've got a store portal, a store site, whatever you want to call it. But through our store portal, it can operate a couple of different ways. Number one, the end user customer can come out there and do their own unassisted web-based ordering. Just like, you know, if you go out to walmart.com, cdw.com, that's the way our storefront works as well. It's a very easy to set up storefront because it's all template-based. Don't have to know HTML or anything like that. We've got everything included that the reseller needs, including the content. But it makes it very easy for the end user customer to go out at any point in time, take a look at product specs, images. We've got rich content available that is included with what we provide. They can do their own side-by-side product comparisons. They can put products into a shopping cart, check out, and then the reseller gets the order. Or this can also be an interactive way to get your quotes out to your customer. Let the customer see the product specs electronically. They can turn the quote into a sales order through the storefront, and then the reseller can process it however they choose.
How sort of penetrated is this market? Like, what percentage would you say of VARs or MSPs are giving their customers that kind of storefront capability?
Ooh, I'm not sure if I could put a percentage number to it. I can tell you that, you know, I've been with CNET and I've been representing Channel Online for well over 10 years. Over the past 18 months, I'm seeing more and more people come to us because they want to hang some type of store portal out there to make it easier for their customers to order from them. So it's definitely a trend that we're seeing increase as we go.
How would you describe the nature of that opportunity and maybe the size of that opportunity for the MSP or VAR?
We've done a lot of research on this, and we've consulted some of the, you know, the experts like Forrester, and some of the numbers that they have shown us is that right now, about two-thirds of businesses are actually researching their corporate purchases online. So if you don't have a storefront, or a store portal, they're not researching it with you. Now, B2B purchases, and when I say B2B, I'm talking business to business here. B2B purchases are expected to grow to 53% of it happening online by next year, 2018. So over half of B2B purchases are going to be happening through store portals. Some of the other numbers that we have seen, you know, a lot of times people consider e-commerce and storefronts and all of that stuff as all B2C. And B2C is huge, and according to Forrester, they're saying it's going to be about $480 billion by 2019. But what a lot of people I don't think realize is how big the B2B market space is for e-commerce sales. Again, Forrester's projecting B2B e-commerce sales to top $1 trillion by 2019. So you're seeing this is twice the B2C market potential. So it's huge, and they're saying double-digit growth, year-over-year growth through 2020.
How does the pricing work on this?
Pricing for Channel Online, I'm assuming you're asking for the reseller that
yes.
wants to use Channel Online. Just want to make sure. Pricing for Channel Online for the reseller for the MSP, it's a subscription-based model, and it's based on the number of users that work for that particular reseller or MSP that they need to have a license to log in and manage their customers, build quotes, manage the storefront, all of that. Our pricing starts for just one user at $198 a month per user. If you've got multiple users, we do have tiered pricing. So the more users you have, the less you're paying per user per month.
All right. And that was Mr. Rich Freeman talking with Larry Meter of Channel Online. Oh, I do love the dings and bells and the very, very nice sounds. You guys were in a very quiet area, too. That's like one of the clearest interviews I've heard from you since you guys like weren't out in the middle of the show floor or something.
It was a nice change of pace.
Yeah, but you can. I think you can start to see where this dovetails right in with the feature we were talking about before we started the interview about self-service and that people and this whole idea of having a storefront that allows because your customers want to do research, they want to buy stuff, but they don't necessarily like want to call you and be like, hey, I need this. They want to do their research and. This is a great mechanism in order to kind of bring more of that self-service aspect to your business. Am I kind of getting some of that right, Rich?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, so Channel Online, as I understand it, started out basically being a tool that channel partners could use to quote and place orders, essentially. So, I mean, it was channel-facing, if you will, and the idea was this was sort of a unified interface that was going to collect information from all the big distributors and manufacturers and so on, and you could kind of comparison shop and so on. And the self-serve storefront functionality, I forget how long ago they added that, but that's something that they added later on. And it's, you know, it's exactly like the help desk conversation in a sense, in that it's, you know, for the channel partner, it's sort of an opportunity to offload, you know, you don't have to assemble these quotes or place these orders if the customer is doing it for you. And at the same time, you're helping the customer shop the way that they want to shop. And as Larry kind of pointed out, I believe in the interview there, is you can kind of do a combo of that a little bit where, you know, the end user does the comparison shopping on the tool and then tells you what they want, and you go ahead and place the order for them because maybe they don't feel confident doing that or whatever. But it's yet another case where you're giving the customer what they want, and in the process, you're both collecting some incremental revenue, maybe from hardware and software sales that you weren't doing before because you just didn't have the bandwidth to deal with that, and you're relieving yourself of some of that hardware and software ordering burden maybe that you're dealing with now.
Well, not to mention, I've been pushing a lot the last year, talking a lot about these other high margin lucrative areas that resellers are missing out on because they're not pushing it. And a lot of times it's these little things that, you know, you don't need to, you don't want to like work with them to sell accessories and certain things like that. But if you can offer a storefront where these customers can go and shop at, there's a lot of potential there that you're missing out of. And I think something like this is a great way of grabbing the business back from where these customers might go when they need new mouse pads, new office chairs, new whatever. You know, like if you can make that that store experience comprehensive, there's a lot of money and sales that you may have lost to outside places. My thought.
No, it's absolutely. It's like here's a way to collect some of that extra revenue without actually having to build some whole new piece of your business, in a sense. You don't even really need to understand those accessory markets all that well. You can just kind of come up with some way to point your customers to the storefront and basically say, hey, okay, we've equipped you with new laptops. You know, you really ought to take a look at cases and all these other goodies, and here's a place where you can find some good stuff and let them go to town and do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Love it. Cool. So you got anything on that interview you want to ask about, questions, or should we move on? Very good. Let's do that. All right, cool. So we are going to take one final break, and when we come back, we're going to hit a few of our regular end-of-the-show features a couple things like that. So stick around. We'll be right back. All right, and we are back. Going to do some of our regular end-of-the-show features here in part three of Channel Pro Weekly. So let's first start with one thing that we do every single week. We love to follow our associate publisher, Mr. Joel Zaitzpinner, around the country and around the world as he travels 40-some weeks out of the year for Channel Pro. Lives in hotels and airplanes, eats in fine restaurants everywhere, and we just like to play Where's Waldo with him to see, you know, where he is at any given time, and everybody likes to play along. So this week, where's Joel?
Well, I mentioned before he was here with me in New Orleans, but you just can't tie that man down for more than a day or two at a time. So right now, he is in Columbus, Ohio at an ASCII event.
Ah!
Oh, jeez. I had no idea.
So from New Orleans, I would have much rather stay in New Orleans, personally. Nothing against Columbus. Yeah. Columbus is nice, but come on, New Orleans, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So from New Orleans, Louisiana to Columbus, Ohio in the Midwest, Mr. Joel is all over the place. If you see him, if you spot him, share your Joel sightings with us and help us keep track of him, because sometimes we don't even know where he is. Sometimes I don't even know if he knows where he is. All right. So
that's an interesting observation.
I don't know if that's true or not, but it could be. If I was on the road that much, I would probably forget where I am half the time.
Can you imagine like waking up in the morning after like a late night and you're in a hotel and you're like, okay, where am I and what am I doing here?
Which state am I in?
This happens, not quite that, but something like that happens to me far more often than you would think, where I know, you know, where I am and why I'm there, but it's like I wake up in the hotel room and it's like, okay, wait a minute, you know, the window is where and the bathroom is, you know, I'm just totally disoriented.
Yep.
Very cool. All right, so this week we do have a reader mailbag. Yay! We got some feedback.
Whoa.
So this was sent to Mr. Rich. Mr. Rich, you are welcome to read this, or I can go ahead and do it.
Well, I was just going to kind of paraphrase it. If you want to read it, that would be great. But folks who listened to our last episode know we spent some time talking about an announcement by Cinex that they had been named the exclusive North American distributor of HP's big commercial 3D printing system, and then we spent some time kind of talking about, okay, when they say exclusive, do they mean exclusive? And I wasn't 100% sure, but we got it turns out somebody in their PR organization listens to our podcast, and thank you very much for doing that. And she contacted us to say, yeah, when we say exclusive, we mean exclusive, because that's a very – that's a powerful word. You know, the lawyers are very particular about when you can use a word like that, and so – it means we are the only one here.
Yep. She says, to verify that that is, in fact, an exclusive contract with HP and the 3D Jet Fusion printers, our legal department won't let us use that word unless it's legally or contractually true. But that is not all. The only interesting thing in this email. She also said, anyway, you three are funny, and for the record, I'd pick you as the Riddler. So, Rich, you're the Riddler. So this was from Jennifer.
It would have been funnier if she would have said, I'm sorry, if she would have said, okay, you can be the Riddler, Matt, you can be somebody else. And
no, it's all good. It's all good. Rich is very Riddler-esque, only because I think he likes to wear green tights with question marks all over him.
Yeah, I sent her back a picture.
No, what was
Frank
it?
Gorshin.
T-shirts with buttons.
It was what?
T-shirts with buttons.
T-shirts with...
Didn't Rich have a T-shirt with buttons?
Did you have a T-shirt with buttons?
Oh, this came up
yes.
in a podcast once upon a time. Yeah, and now I can't remember the context. I do not, in fact, have a T-shirt with buttons, but I think you guys were convinced I did. Something like that.
You could have a T-shirt like designed like a sport coat, though. That would save you a lot of time. Because then you'd only need one article of clothing instead of two. Anyway, so thank you. That was from Jennifer Oladipo? Oladipo from Hughes Agency. So, Jennifer, thank you for listening. We definitely appreciate it. And... and I agree, Rich is the Riddler. That he's the most Riddler-esque of all of us. So if you would like to send in your comments or feedback, please, we want to hear your comments. Send them to us, podcast@channelpornetwork.com, or on any of the various social networks. We'll talk about those later. So you can be a part of our reader mailbag part of the show. And, you know, it can be a question, it can be a comment, it can be... deciding which of us would be the best Batman villain, as we figured out in this case with Rich. So whatever it is, send it in and let us know. Generally, I do a museum pick every week. We are running right up to the wire here, and I have to like leave in 4 minutes now, 3 minutes. So I think I'm going to skip the museum pick this week. But I do have a tech pick for you that I'll talk about real quick because there's not a lot to say about it. But I was talking with someone else who. Also does listen to the show and a little bit more of a technical kind of person. And they said, hey, you know, you've never mentioned any firewalls on the show or done any picks in firewalls. And we've done other things. So I agree. I agree that this is a area that has gone ignored for far too long. So I have chosen a couple different WatchGuard solutions this time to talk about. So my tech pick this week is if you're looking for a very drop-in SMB tabletop firewall, my pick here is going to be the WatchGuard T50. And I know what people are going to say, well, why not the T30? The reason why I say the T50 is because when it comes down to it, the price difference between these two is not very significant. I don't know if the extra 2 1-gig ports really make a difference, but the performance of the T50 is basically almost double that of the T30. And so if you're dropping this into an SMB, you know, and you, they might have 15 users, they might have whatever, I think you're going to appreciate the extra performance overhead that the T50 offers. But it's also very simple to drop in and deploy, but that extra performance will let the user kind of grow a little bit, and you're not going to have to worry too much about running into any real performance problems. So that would be my kind of tabletop SMB firewall choice. But if you need a rack mount one, as most of you probably would if you're deploying this in a small business, my choice there is the M300. So the M300, I chose that again in a very similar look. If you start looking at the specs on these, the M300, it's got a little bit more horsepower, can handle a lot more users. So I think if you're going to drop something in, and again, the price difference between the 200 and 300 isn't significant, I would say that give yourself the extra room to grow and handle more users and a little bit higher performance. So that's my firewall picks of for this week, the M300, if you need a rack version, or the T50, if you need a tabletop. And yes, you can get the T in. I didn't pick the wireless one. I don't think you're going to need it. But if you need wireless, you can get the T50W, but the T50. So now, Cecilia, I know that you are very particular about the types of firewalls you deploy.
Absolutely. And WatchGuard's one of my faves.
Right, but the reason why, this is actually interesting to point out, and I'm going to be late now to my thing, but that's fine. The reason, I loved your reasoning why you really like the WatchGuard ones. Can you share that reasoning?
Because, yes, they're beautiful. They're red, they're glossy, they show up beautifully in print. So WatchGuard,
they do have very nice striking job. Designs. Like, in a rack, you cannot ignore the fact that there is a, or miss the fact that there's a WatchGuard product in that rack, because they are like fire engine red and really, really cool looking. But I know you're also, you worry a lot about, full UTM protection and all that kind of stuff. Right. So,
absolutely. It's gotta be good.
And
it's
good.
Gotta be beautiful and good.
These two deliver in spades. Disagree with
really
me?
Really good.
If you disagree with me,
you got it. No, I agree. I agree with you.
But the listeners, 100%. If the listeners disagree, I kind of picked, some small business firewalls here. I was thinking, something for a small tabletop deployment and like an SMB kind of rack model. But if you're doing 1,000 users, these are not the right products for that. But if you disagree, if you know of a better drop-in firewall or have your own that you like to use for whatever reason, tell us about it. podcast@channel4network.com or hit us on the social networks, which we'll talk about here in a minute, with your choices for firewalls. Rich, the Riddler himself. Riddle me this. What happened and what's going to happen next week?
Well, I will tell you and all of our listeners what happened in my weekly In Case You Missed It post, which appears on our website every Friday. So I've been at the Veeam event this week, but we're going to have some news out of the week's other big events. That would be SAP's Sapphire Now show, Microsoft's SharePoint Virtual Summit, and the Google I/O Developer Conference. Plus, I will tell you a little bit about a new beer from Denmark that is made from, and you're just going to have to read to find out what it's made from because it's kind of hard to believe. And then every Monday morning, first thing, my What's Up This Week post appears and sets you up for the week ahead, which next week is going to include the Citrix Synergy Show, a Spiceworks conference that actually takes place in London, but is probably going to produce some interesting news. Those folks always have something interesting cooking. And then another mystery event from Microsoft. The last time they hosted an event and didn't tell anybody what it was going to be about was just a few weeks ago, and it turned out to be their big Chromebook competitor deal where they shipped Windows 10S. Nobody knows what they're going to be announcing next week, but the event takes place in Shanghai, so I'm guessing it might be hardware-related. We'll see. And then in honor of Memorial Day weekend, which is coming up, we will, that's the start of the annual grilling season, so we'll take a quick look at the origins of barbecue, which is not actually the same thing as grilling, but is a wonderful
I'm
American
a big fan of grilling.
Innovation.
Got to tell you. I got a lot of grills. So, Rich, do you have a favorite?
Me too.
I have
I do not have
any grills in my basement.
Including some in your basement, I'm sure.
I do not. But I do have, let's see, I think I have four grills. I have two gas grills and a nice 17.5-inch kettle grill, and then a small portable travel kettle charcoal grill as well. Because you never know when you might want to grill up some steaks or some burgers or some fish or ribs or any other kind of meat product. I do not have a
grill. You have a grill museum.
It's Trace. But that, you know what, that's kind of funny, though, because even, I mean, I would say that there's been a huge evolution of design and stuff in terms of gas grills. But actually, if you look at charcoal grilling, I mean, I think the very first Weber grill, the big Cattleman's, you know, Weber grill that they made, you know, way, way back in the day, is still made today, right? There's like, how much innovation is there in charcoal grilling? But on the charcoal itself and the briquettes, I'm sure. Okay, we're getting way off topic now. So very cool. Yeah, very cool. And I really do need to get going here.
Move on.
Girls Little League softball team waiting for me to show up and help them in their game here. So with that, we're going to wrap up. So that will conclude episode 45. Please, if you have not yet subscribed to Channel Pro Weekly, please do so. Go to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are aggregated, and subscribe there, and let the shows come down to you each and every week as they get put up into the little digital bits that get float around the internet and come down to your computer, phone, or tablet, or whatever device you happen to listen on. If you have feedback, comments, questions, want to be part of the reader mailbag, send us an email, podcast@channelpronetwork.com, and we will read that here on the show. If you are on Facebook, we are Channel Pro Network on Facebook, so please like us there. Cecilia has a Twitter account, don't you, Cecilia? And what is that?
I do.
And Rich, you are?
At Seal Gal.
At Matt Whitlock on Twitter if you want to follow any of the three of us personally. Otherwise, one of the best ways to kind of know what's happening on the website is to follow the Channel Pro SMB account. So at Channel Pro SMB, follow that, and you'll get rapid links to all the new stories and all kinds of stuff going on there. So why don't you do that as well? Yes.
One quick thing I want to add to our end of show thing is on our website, www.channelpronetwork.com, you will find a link to our reader's choice survey. Please go vote. We've shortened up the survey. We've made it a lot quicker for
we really do need your votes for reader's choice awards. It's very important.
We need your votes.
And Make your voice heard. It's a big one, and lots of people will be looking at this list. So definitely be a part of it. So www.channelpronetwork.com, and find the link to the Reader's Choice Awards survey, and be a part of Reader Choice Awards history. On behalf of everybody here at Channel Pro, myself, Rich, and Cecilia, Mr. Joel, Mr. Siggins, and the rest, we will see you all next week.